Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
I'm Ray Langton. I'm a philosophy professor at Cambridge, and I work in moral philosophy, political philosophy, feminist philosophy, history of philosophy, especially Kant, and a range of other areas, metaphysics, epistemology. And I'm really glad to be part of your podcast series, Kieran. It's a great idea. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And I'm very grateful that you were able to make time for it. I know you, like many academic administrators, heads of departments, have been very busy this summer. So I really appreciate it. So as you know, my inspiration for the podcast is Iris Murdoch. You hear her at the beginning of every episode telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but she also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. And that's the question I always start with. Does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
So I don't think philosophy is about exploring your temperament. And it couldn't really be about exploring your temperament if it was also, you know, trying to find stuff out. But it might nevertheless reveal something about your temperament. And I think probably that's what she meant. Kieran, you know far more about Iris Murdoch than I do. But if you're looking outwards to find stuff out, you are not looking inwards to self-explore. And that whole business of trying to explore your temperament sounds too much like what she doesn't like when she talks about the fat, relentless ego being the bane of moral life.
Yeah, I think that's true, that there's supposed to be a kind of tension or problem in this feature of philosophy that she's grappling with. That there's also a contrast between the idea of philosophy as exploring your temperament, as you said, and the idea of it revealing your temperament. So I sort of cheat a little bit in the question by shifting from the idea of exploring your temperament to asking whether it influences your philosophy. I mean, would you say that your temperament shows up in your philosophical work, even if you're not exploring it?
How does my temperament influence my philosophy? I'd have to know what my temperament is to be able to answer that. And I'm not really sure I do know what it is. I don't think it's about exploring my temperament, though I'm sure that you are revealing all sorts of limitations and obsessions in what you do when you're doing philosophy. Because what we do is always socially situated, that's as true of me as it is of you and as of everybody else. And this is what spells out the scope and the limits of what we're doing, but that's hard to see from the inside. So I'm sorry, I haven't got a very good answer to this question.
Well, I think it's funny, that probably is a good answer. It's just not a direct answer. I mean, I think that's probably the best answer to give in the circumstances. I think this is true that people are invited by this question to speculate about their temperaments. And part of what's revealing about it is what they say, what people say about their own temperaments, like how they understand themselves. And one is often not in a position to really be authoritative about that. It's not one of the cases where self-knowledge is easy. Well, I'm going to ask you a second question that also cheats, like the first question, but in a new and different way. And this one is more about your own experience of philosophy, something that you might be able to speak about from the inside. And so the cheat is that I'm going to combine two questions. One of them is, have you changed your mind about anything important in philosophy? And if so, how? And the other question is, has philosophy ever helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty in your life?
Okay, that's great. So I came into philosophy as a teenager because I was struggling with a philosophical question, which is also an emotional and practical question. And that's a question about God. So I was born and raised in India, and I'm the daughter of parents who were missionaries in India. And I was deeply religious my whole childhood, and then began to have doubts as a teenager, like many people do. And there's a sense in which the existence of God is a philosophical question, and we teach it as a philosophical question, but it's also a question about your supposed relationship with this being who is supposed to be living in your heart and communing with you at all times. So it's a very weird mixture of a philosophical and a deeply personal and emotional question. And so I did change my mind very much about that question. I don't believe that there is any God. And it was very distressing. So that was also an emotional difficulty. So that was a philosophical topic I changed my mind about. And did philosophy actually help with that? I mean, philosophy actually was the cause of the difficulty in some ways, but philosophy also was a help because, I suppose, at its worst, probably in my first year back in Australia in 1980, that was when I was reading Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy. And the lovely thing about Russell and about that book is not only does it give you this extremely generous and idiosyncratic picture of the lives and works of so many philosophers through history, it also has this kind of sensitivity to questions about the meaning of life and the role of God in the meaning of life. So you sort of have the sense of Russell almost shaking his fist at God for not existing. And I found that incredibly comforting somehow, because all of my friends were sort of very happy in their general agnosticism. And for me, it was as if, you know, all the color had been taken out of my life and the sense of loss was so profound. But having somebody like Russell, who actually in his own writings captured the sense of what could be missing and the sense of the possibility of creation in the face of all of that, I actually found that really inspiring, and it was one of the things that drew me into philosophy.
Well, there are so many questions I want to ask about this. One is, not having been ever religious myself, really, although I went to church when I was a kid in a dutiful and absent-minded way, do you remember, like, do you feel like you can re-enter your experience of being deeply religious? Like, what was it like?
Well, for one thing, you would never think of it as under the description religious.
Yeah.
I know for Iris Murdoch, the words we use to describe our experience are so important. And you would never, a religious person would never think I'm religious. You would be thinking in terms of a relationship with Jesus, and you would be in communication. I mean, prayer is this sort of constant communication. It's not just prayer, it's also the world seems full of all kinds of meaning. So my parents would see meaning all over the place. So the slightest contingent little thing would be a sign that God was trying to tell them something. Don't you think the Lord might be trying to tell us something? And it led them into all kinds of adventure, but it was, so can I get myself back into it? Yes, very easily. So part of it is the sense of a different kind of interpretation of the contingencies of life. But part of it also was the sense of the collapsing and tying together of ideas about God with ideas about value and what matters. And in retrospect, I think that is the most pernicious thing. I don't think religion should be tied up at all with ethics. I think that is one of the worst legacies of religion, because it makes ethics, it makes value, it makes what matters hostage to a piece of metaphysics which is just false, and there's absolutely no need for it. So actually, if I could just go back to your other question about whether philosophy helped with anything.
Yeah.
Much later, so not in my late teens, but much later, I came across Plato's famous argument in the Euthyphro. Well, you can't just call it an argument, because it's a conversation like the one we're having. It's a conversation about what the pious is, or what piety is, what the good is. And the question to Euthyphro was whether piety is good because the gods love it, or whether the gods love it because it's good. I'm somewhat oversimplifying. And when I came across that much later, after I had sort of, you know, made peace with the world as I saw initially, stripped of its theistic and moral colour. I actually found that tremendously, I think Plato was quite right about that. Suppose we say that lying is wrong, and suppose we ask ourselves why, and the religious person says, well, that's because God says it's wrong. It's in the Ten Commandments, as thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbour. And then you ask, well, so why did God say that? Suppose God had said, thou shalt bear false witness against thy neighbour. Would that have made lying right? Of course not. So God saying so isn't what's making it so. God might be telling you about what's right, and he might know what's right, but that doesn't actually make it right. So matters of value, matters of right and wrong, these are quite independent of religion, and it's a huge mistake for a religion to tangle them up together. And I still think it's one of, I think it's one of the most dangerous, you know, remnants of religion now.
Can I ask one other follow-up about your initial description of losing your belief in God and then reading Bertrand Russell and finding his explorations of philosophy to somehow pick up on or kind of give you a sense of how philosophy might speak to the kind of meaning that you were losing and return it to you in another way? I mean, has philosophy, as you've gone on to do it in your career, met that aspiration for you?
Yes, it has, but not necessarily in the way that it did for Russell. So he was inspired by the vast Arctic snowscapes of logic and philosophy of mathematics, and he found them tremendously inspiring. I've found other parts of philosophy more inspiring than that. When I was a graduate student at Princeton, I began to get a sense that philosophy could help you not just understand, but also address all kinds of challenges in social life that I hadn't really noticed. So when I came to Princeton before that, I had worked mostly in the history of philosophy and in metaphysics. But when I came to Princeton, thanks to the unit requirement system, I had to do ethics and political philosophy. And, well, let's see, people who were there included Will Kimlicker, Susan Bryson, Sally Haslinger, Michael Smith. And with them, I came across philosophy of law, and I came across really exciting but challenging confrontations between certain sorts of liberal political philosophy and critiques that came from different quarters, from feminist philosophy and from critical race theory. And it just opened up a whole world. And people don't always think of Princeton as the place where you might make those sorts of discoveries. But when I was there, it really was eye-opening.
Well, talking about grad school might connect with question three. Or it might not. I don't want to load the dice. But the question is, what is your worst moment as a philosopher?
I think if you said that, Kieran, you probably saw my career lowlights, which are there along with my career highlights.
I have seen it, yes. Yes.
So on my Noonan biography, I put some career lowlights. So one of the lowlights that I included was a not-so-pleasant experience at Princeton, which was when I finished my thesis, when I finished my dissertation on Kant and submitted it. And in fact, I at that point was living in Australia and had booked my flight to cross the world to come and defend my thesis. I had the very embarrassing experience of having my thesis failed. And so I arrived in Princeton with no thesis to defend because this thesis had not been passed. So that was extremely demoralizing. I have to say I was discouraged, but I wasn't too discouraged because I don't know whether to be embarrassed or pleased or a mixture. But prior to this humiliation, the thesis had in fact been accepted by OUP as a book. And that's my book about Kant, Kantian Humility, Ignorance of Things in Themselves. So that was definitely a career lowlight. I'm not sure it's my worst moment as a philosopher, but it certainly is a low point. Do you want me to mention another low point?
Well, I think if you're willing to, yes, because it's intriguing that that wasn't your first choice as a worst moment and that there were other things to talk about.
The first one I was going to mention was an experience at the University of Sydney, where I did my honours degree, and where, by the way, I had a really terrific time doing my honours year, the honours year being the Australian sort of fourth year. And I had moved from one philosophy department in Sydney to another philosophy department in Sydney. That might sound strange, but Sydney at that point had two philosophy departments. Feyerabend actually makes a joke about this in one of his papers. He says Sydney has one opera house, one harbour bridge, and two philosophy departments. Anyway, and then he proceeds to hoe into some of the philosophers. Anyway, I had begun at Sydney in the Department of General Philosophy, which was broadly continental, and moved for my honours year into the Department of Traditional and Modern Philosophy, which was broadly analytic, though that stereotype doesn't really quite fit. They had split in the 70s over questions about whether Marxism counted as philosophy. And I won't go into all of that history, although it is fascinating if you like that sort of thing. Anyway, getting back to a low point. So I had had a very bad upbringing as far as the philosophers like David Armstrong were concerned, because I had spent my early years in the enemy department. So you have to picture David Armstrong presenting his book on laws of nature to an assembled audience of mostly men wearing tweed jackets and smoking pipes, some of them anyway. And the board, as far as I was concerned, was covered with gobbledygook. It was covered with upside down A's and back to front E's. And there were various phrases that I hadn't heard before. And I put up my hand a bit like Oliver Twist coming to the front and asking for soup. I put up my hand, and this was in a context where students never asked any questions. I put up my hand and I said, "Excuse me, what do you mean when you say modus tollens?" So I then received a very gratified response from David Armstrong, who was so thrilled at this proof of the poor education that the enemy department had supplied me with. So he peered at me from under his bushy eyebrows and shook his head and said, GP, meaning general philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then he proceeded to explain in words a five-year-old could understand what this form of argument could be. And the nice thing about this event, though, and there were lots and lots of nice things about this department, the nice thing about it was that after this humiliation, as I was leaving the room, Keith Campbell came up to me and just took me aside. And he said, "Ray, don't stop asking questions, will you?" And I said, "Thanks, okay, and I won't." And I didn't. And I actually had a really good time there, although I was made to take an extra remedial year because of my bad upbringing.
Well, given the bad moments, there may be a segue to question four, which is about doing things other than philosophy. So I'm going to ask this one next. So if you weren't a philosopher, what would you do instead?
So when I first started studying at university in Australia, this was immediately after I had returned to Australia from India, where I spent my entire youth and childhood. So I didn't know very much about anything. And I wanted to study English literature because I loved poetry and drama. And I wanted to study biology because I loved plants, especially plants, also animals. And when I proposed mixing these interests and studying English and biology, the answer was, no, you can't. You have to pick another art subject. So I ended up picking philosophy and just got hooked almost right away. I really loved it. As I said, I got so excited when I started reading History of Western Philosophy. But so I was interested in literature and I was interested in biology, especially botany. And when I think what is my other life, probably it would have to have been at a different point in history. My other life would have been as a botanist, especially an explorer botanist. So I'd be traveling on one of those explorer ships, finding new plants. I'd be doing extremely nerdy things like finding out about the very weird reproductive habits of mosses and liverworts that nobody had noticed before. I was absolutely besotted with mosses and ferns, and I still get a kick out of all of that. So now I channel all that into my enthusiasm for gardening. That's probably my alternative career, although there were others along the way, because I had to support myself quite a lot through university, partly through because of the advice for extra remedial teaching. But on the botany, there is an embarrassing fact that I've confessed elsewhere, which is that I'm better at remembering the Latin names for plants than I am at remembering the ordinary names for people.
Yeah, or the Latin names for types of arguments. that's now been drilled into you.
The Latin names for plants are a lot easier than the Latin names for arguments. Yeah.
I'm going to move us on to our final question, which is another Iris Murdoch question. So it begins with a quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is she afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
Well, it's a significant question to ask about anyone, what they're afraid of, not just a philosopher. And the things that I'm afraid of include small things and big things, and the small things and big things are probably pretty similar to those that many people are afraid of. The small things would be you end up not spending enough time on the things that really matter, whether in life or in philosophy. And then with the big things, well, you're asking this question at a time when there's a pandemic raging across the world and we're in a climate emergency. And so the big things that I'm afraid of are the big things that so many of us are afraid of. They're to do with a really serious threat that we face, the threat that the one thing we do have, this small blue planet that we all live on and our life together on it, that we just might mess it up totally. So that's what I'm more afraid of than anything else, but that is not particularly what I'm afraid of as a philosopher. Although as a philosopher, I suppose I'm also a bit afraid of looking back and thinking, perhaps I should worry that I've been spending more time on questions that fascinate me than on questions that really matter.
Well, that is a fear I definitely share, and probably a good one on which to end the conversation and let it hang in between us, and say thank you, Ray, so much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Kieran.
Ray Langton is Knightbridge Professor of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge and the author of Kantian Humility and Sexual Solipsism. Well, before I sign off, I'm going to announce with regret that this is the final episode of the first season of Five Questions. I'll leave you with two requests. First, if you feel like leaving a 5-star rating or review at Apple or iTunes, that would be great. Apparently, they help people find the podcast. Second, and more important, if you're eligible to vote in the US election and you haven't done that yet, please vote. I hope to be back when the dust of the election settles. Meanwhile, thanks for listening to Five Questions.